Chapters 19 and 20 of John Barleycorn, or Alcoholic Memoirs, by Jack London. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 19. When I was with people who did not drink, I never thought of drinking. Lewis did not drink. Neither he nor I could afford it, but more significant than that, we had no desire to drink. We were healthy, normal, non-alcoholic. Had we been alcoholic, we would have drunk whether or not we could have afforded it. Each night after the day's work, washed up, clothes changed, and supper eaten, we met on the street corner or in the little candy store. But the warm fall weather passed, and on bitter nights of frost or damp nights of drizzle, the street corner was not a comfortable meeting place, and the candy store was unheated. Nita, or whoever waited on the counter, between waitings lurked in a back living room that was heated. We were not admitted to this room, and in the store it was as cold as out of doors. Lewis and I debated the situation. There was only one solution. The saloon, the congregating place of men, the place where men hobnobbed with John Barleycorn. Well do I remember the damp and drafty evening, shivering without overcoats because we could not afford them, that Lewis and I started out to select our saloon. Saloons are always warm and comfortable. Now, Lewis and I did not go into this saloon because we wanted a drink. Yet we knew that saloons were not charitable institutions. A man could not make a lounging place of a saloon without occasionally buying something over the bar. Our dimes and nickels were few. We could ill spare any of them when they were so potent in paying car fare for oneself and a girl. We never paid car fare when by ourselves, being content to walk. So in this saloon, we desired to make the most of our expenditure. We called for a deck of cards and sat down at a table and played euchre for an hour, in which time Lewis treated once and I treated once to beer, the cheapest drink, 10 cents for two. Prodigal, how we grudged it. We studied the men who came into the place. They seemed all middle-aged and elderly workmen, most of them German, who flocked by themselves in old acquaintance groups, and with whom we could have only the slightest contacts. We voted against that saloon and went out cast down with the knowledge that we had lost an evening and wanted 20 cents for beer that we didn't want. We made several more tries on succeeding nights and at last found our way into the National, a saloon on 10th and Franklin. Here was a more congenial crowd. Here Lewis met a fellow or two he knew, and here I met fellows I had gone to school with when a little lad in knee pants. We talked of old days and of what had become of this fellow and what that fellow was doing now, and of course we talked it over drinks. They treated and we drank. Then, according to the code of drinking, we had to treat. It hurt, for it meant 40 to 50 cents a clatter. We felt quite enlivened when the short evening was over, but at the same time we were bankrupt. Our week's spending money was gone. We decided that that was the saloon for us and we agreed to be more circumspect thereafter in our drink buying. Also, we had to economize for the rest of the week. We didn't even have carfare. We were compelled to break an engagement with two girls from West Oakland with whom we were attempting to be in love. They were to meet us uptown the next evening, and we hadn't the carfare necessary to take them home. Like many others financially embarrassed, we had to disappear for a time from the gay world, at least until Saturday night payday. So Lewis and I rendezvoused in a livery stable, and with coats buttoned and chattering teeth, played euchre and casino until the time of our exile was over. Then we returned to the National Saloon and spent no more than we could decently avoid spending for the comfort and warmth. Sometimes we had mishaps, as when one got stuck twice in succession in a five-handed game of Sancho Pedro for the drinks. Such a disaster meant anywhere between 25 to 80 cents, just according to how many of the players ordered 10-cent drinks. But we could temporarily escape the evil effects of such disaster by virtue of an account we ran behind the bar. Of course, this only set back the day of reckoning and seduced us into spending more than we could have spent on a cash basis. When I left Oakland suddenly for the adventure path the following spring, I well remember I owed that saloon keeper $1.70. Long after, when I returned, he was gone. I still owe him that $1.70, and if he should chance to read these lines, I want him to know that I'll pay on demand. The foregoing incident of the National Saloon I have given in order again to show the lure, or draw, or compulsion toward John Barleycorn in society as at present organized, with saloons on all the corners. Lewis and I were two healthy youths. We didn't want to drink. We couldn't afford to drink. And yet we were driven by the circumstance of cold and rainy weather to seek refuge in a saloon, where we had to spend part of our pitiful dole for drink. It will be urged by some critics that we might have gone to the YMCA, to night school, and to the social circles and homes of young people. The only reply is that we didn't. That is the irrefragable fact. We didn't. And today, at this moment, there are hundreds of thousands of boys like Lewis and me doing just what Lewis and I did with John Barleycorn, warm and comfortable, beckoning and welcoming, tucking their arms in his and beginning to teach them his mellow ways. Chapter 20. The jute mills failed of its agreement to increase my pay to $1.25 a day, and I, a free-born American boy whose direct ancestors had fought in all the wars from the old pre-revolutionary Indian Wars down, exercised my sovereign right of free contract by quitting the job. I was still resolved to settle down, and I looked about me. One thing was clear: unskilled labor didn't pay. I must learn a trade, and I decided on electricity. The need for electricians was constantly growing. But how to become an electrician? I hadn't the money to go to a technical school or university. Besides, I didn't think much of schools. I was a practical man in a practical world. Also, I still believed in the old myths which were the heritage of the American boy when I was a boy. A canal boy could become a president. Any boy who took employment with any firm could, by thrift, energy, and sobriety, learn the business and rise from position to position until he was taken in as a junior partner. After that, the senior partnership was only a matter of time. Very often, so ran the myth, the boy, by reason of his steadiness and application, married his employer's daughter. By this time, I had been encouraged to such faith in myself in the matter of girls that I was quite certain I would marry my employer's daughter. There wasn't a doubt of it. All the little boys in the myths did it as soon as they were old enough. So I bade farewell forever to the adventure path and went out to the power plant of one of our Oakland Street railways. I saw the superintendent himself in a private office so fine that it almost stunned me. But I talked straight up. I told him I wanted to become a practical electrician. That I was unafraid of work, that I was used to hard work, and that all he had to do was look at me to see I was fit and strong. I told him that I wanted to begin right at the bottom and work up, that I wanted to devote my life to this one occupation and this one employment. The superintendent beamed as he listened. He told me that I was the right stuff for success, and that he believed in encouraging American youth that wanted to rise. Why, employers were always on the lookout for young fellows like me, and alas, they found them all too rarely. My ambition was fine and worthy, and he would see to it that I got my chance. And as I listened with swelling heart, I wondered if it was his daughter I was to marry. Before you can go out on the road and learn the more complicated and higher details of the profession, he said, you will, of course, have to work in the car house with the men who install and repair the motors. By this time, I was sure that it was his daughter, and I was wondering how much stock he might own in the company. But, he said, as you yourself so plainly see, you couldn't expect to begin as a helper to the car house electricians. That will come when you have worked up to it. You will really begin at the bottom. In the car house, your first employment will be sweeping up, washing the windows, keeping things clean. And after you have shown yourself satisfactory at that, then you may become a helper to the car house electricians. I didn't see how sweeping and scrubbing a building was any preparation for the trade of electrician, but I did know that in the books all the boys started with the most menial tasks, and by making good ultimately won to the ownership of the whole concern. "When shall I come to work?" I asked, eager to launch on this dazzling career. "But," said the superintendent, "as you and I have already agreed, you must begin at the bottom. Not immediately can you in any capacity enter the car house. Before that, you must pass through the engine room as an oiler." My heart went down slightly, and for the moment, as I saw the road lengthen between his daughter and me, then it rose again. I would be a better electrician with knowledge of steam engines. As an oiler in the great engine room, I was confident that few things concerning steam would escape me. Heavens! My career shone more dazzling than ever. "When shall I come to work?" I asked gratefully. "But," said the superintendent, "you could not expect to enter immediately into the engine room. There must be preparation for that. And through the fire room, of course." "Come, you see the matter clearly, I know. And you will see that even the mere handling of coal, it is a scientific matter and not to be sneered at. Do you know that we weigh every pound of coal we burn? Thus, we learn the value of the coal we buy. We know to a T the last penny of cost of every item of production, and we learn which firemen are the most wasteful. Which firemen, out of stupidity or carelessness, get the least out of the coal they fire?" The superintendent beamed again. "You see how very important the little matter of coal is, and by as much as you learn of this little matter, you will become that much better a workman. More valuable to us, more valuable to yourself. Now, are you prepared to begin?" "Anytime," I said valiantly. "The sooner the better." "Very well," he answered. "You will come tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. I was taken out and shown my duties. Also, I was told the terms of my employment. A 10-hour day. Every day in the month, including Sundays and holidays, with one day off each month, with a salary of $30 a month. It wasn't exciting. Years before, at the cannery, I had earned $1 a day for a 10-hour day. I consoled myself with the thought that the reason my earning capacity had not increased with my years and strength was because I had remained an unskilled laborer. But it was different now. I was beginning to work for skill, for a trade, for career and fortune, and the superintendent's daughter. And I was beginning in the right way, right at the beginning. That was the thing. I was passing coal to the firemen, who shoveled it into the furnaces, where its energy was transformed into steam, which, in the engine room, was transformed into the electricity with which the electricians worked. This passing coal was purely the very beginning. Unless the superintendent should take it into his head to send me to work in the mines from which the coal came in order to get a completer understanding of the genesis of electricity for street railways. Work! I, who had worked with men, found that I didn't know the first thing about real work. A 10-hour day! I had to pass coal for the day and night shifts, and despite working through the noon hour, I never finished my task before 8 at night. I was working a 12 or 13-hour day, and I wasn't being paid overtime as in the cannery. I might as well give the secret away right here. I was doing the work of two men. Before me, one mature, able-bodied laborer had done the day shift, and another equally mature, able-bodied laborer had done the night shift. They had received $40 a month each. The superintendent, bent on an economical administration, had persuaded me to do the work of both men for $30 a month. I thought he was making an electrician of me. In truth and fact, he was saving $50 a month operating expenses to the company. But I didn't know I was displacing two men. Nobody told me. On the contrary, the superintendent warned everybody not to tell me. How valiantly I went at it that first day. I worked at top speed, filling the iron wheelbarrow with coal, running it on the scales and weighing the load, then trundling it into the fire room and dumping it on the plates before the fires. Work! I did more than the two men whom I had displaced. They had merely wheeled in the coal and dumped it on the plates. But while I did this for the day coal, the night coal I had to pile against the wall of the fire room. Now the fire room was small. It had been planned for a night coal passer. So I had to pile the night coal higher and higher, buttressing up the heap with stout planks. Toward the top of the heap, I had to handle the coal a second time, tossing it up with a shovel. I dripped with sweat, but I never ceased from my stride, though I could feel exhaustion coming on. By 10 o'clock in the morning, so much of my body's energy had I consumed, I felt hungry and snatched a thick double slice of bread and butter from my dinner pail. This I devoured, standing, grimed with coal dust, my knees trembling under me. By 11 o'clock, in this fashion, I had consumed my whole lunch. But what of it? I realized that it would enable me to continue working through the noon hour. And I worked all the afternoon. Darkness came on, and I worked under the electric lights. The day fireman went off, and the night fireman came on. I plugged away. At 8:30, famished, tottering, I washed up, changed my clothes, and dragged my weary body to the car. It was 3 miles to where I lived, and I had received a pass with the stipulation that I could sit down as long as there were no paying passengers in need of a seat. As I sank into a corner outside seat, I prayed that no passenger might require my seat. But the car filled up, and halfway in, a woman came on board, and there was no seat for her. I started to get up, and to my astonishment, found that I could not. With the chill wind blowing on me, my spent body had stiffened into the seat. It took me the rest of the run in to unkink my complaining joints and muscles and get into a standing position on the lower ramp. And when the car stopped at my corner, I nearly fell to the ground when I stepped off. I hobbled 2 blocks to the house and limped into the kitchen. While my mother started to cook, I plunged into bread and butter. But before my appetite was appeased, or the steak fried, I was sound asleep. In vain my mother strove to shake me awake enough to eat the meat. Failing in this, with the assistance of my father, she managed to get me to my room, where I collapsed dead asleep on the bed. They undressed me and covered me up. In the morning came the agony of being awakened. I was terribly sore, and worst of all, my wrists were swelling. But I made up for my lost supper eating an enormous breakfast, and when I hobbled to catch my car, I carried a lunch twice as big as the one the day before. Work. Let any youth just turned 18 try to out-shovel two man-grown coal shovelers. Work. Long before midday, I had eaten the last scrap of my huge lunch. But I was resolved to show them what a husky young fellow determined to rise could do. The worst of it was that my wrists were swelling and going back on me. There are few who do not know the pain of walking on a sprained ankle. Then imagine the pain of shoveling coal and trundling a loaded wheelbarrow with two sprained wrists. Work! More than once I sank down on the coal where no one could see me and cried with rage and mortification and exhaustion and despair. That second day was my hardest, and all that enabled me to survive it and get in the last of the night coal at the end of 13 hours was the day fireman, who bound both my wrists with broad leather straps. So tightly were they buckled that they were like slightly flexible plaster casts. They took the stresses and pressures which hitherto had been borne by my wrists, and they were so tight that there was no room for the inflammation to rise in the sprains. And in this fashion, I continued to learn to be an electrician. Night after night, I limped home, fell asleep before I could eat my supper, and was helped into bed and undressed. Morning after morning, always with hunger lunches in my dinner pail, I limped out of the house on my way to work. I no longer read my library books. I made no dates with the girls. I was a proper work beast. I worked and ate and slept while my mind slept all the time. The whole thing was a nightmare. I worked every day, including Sunday, and I looked far ahead to my one day off at the end of a month, resolved to lie abed all that day and just sleep and rest up. The strangest part of this experience was that I never took a drink nor thought of taking a drink. Yet I knew that men under hard pressure almost invariably drank. I had seen them do it, and in the past had often done it myself. But so sheerly non-alcoholic was I that it never entered my mind that a drink might be good for me. I instance this to show how entirely lacking from my makeup was any predisposition toward alcohol. And the point of this instance is that later on, after more years had passed, contact with John Barleycorn at last did induce in me the alcoholic desire. I had often noticed the day fireman staring at me in a curious way. At last, one day, he spoke. He began by swearing me to secrecy. He had been warned by the superintendent not to tell me, and in telling me, he was risking his job. He told me of the day coal passer and the night coal passer and of the wages they had received. I was doing for $30 a month what they had received $80 for doing. He would have told me sooner, the fireman said, had he not been so certain that I would break down under the work and quit. As it was, I was killing myself and all to no good purpose. I was merely cheapening the price of labor, he argued, and keeping two men out of a job. Being an American boy, and a proud American boy, I did not immediately quit. This was foolish of me, I know. but I resolved to continue the work long enough to prove to the superintendent that I could do it without breaking down. Then I would quit, and he would realize what a fine young fellow he had lost. All of which I faithfully and foolishly did. I worked on until the time came when I got in the last of the night coal by 6 o'clock. Then I quit the job of learning electricity by doing more than two men's work for a boy's wages, went home, and proceeded to sleep the clock round. Fortunately, I had not stayed by the job long enough to injure myself, though I was compelled to wear straps on my wrists for a year afterward. But the effect of this work orgy in which I had indulged was to sicken me with work. I just wouldn't work. The thought of work was repulsive. I didn't care if I never settled down. Learning a trade could go hang. It was a whole lot better to roister and frolic over the world in the way I had previously done. So I headed out on the adventure path again, starting to tramp east by beating my way on the railroads. End of chapter 20.